where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
So you wake up in the morning just to work and fight yourself, and then somebody tells you that you're owned by someone else. So what's it all about? It's money! Work it out!
Yes, it's all about the money. And, you know, good on New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Free college for people making under $100,000 a year at these state universities. Good stuff. I mean, that's where we should be moving, not in the opposite direction of profitizing and privatizing education, especially at the K through 12 years. Just amazing stuff. And then the other part of it is, look, now that we've got a Secretary of Education who is committedly someone who wants to privatize and profitize education, the questions come up, who? Where should we be spending this money? And should some of these organizations, well, should they take it? And here to talk about that, I've asked Cheryl Gibbs Binkley to come talk with us. She's a blogger over with the Badass Teachers Association. She's written a great piece on why congregations across the country maybe should stand against the vouchers. Cheryl, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Always nice to talk with you, Rick.
So you see all of this money going into education. Why shouldn't the churches, why shouldn't the congregations, why shouldn't they get their hands on some of it?
The biggest reason is that it's not in their best interest. The separation of church and state is a long-held value of most of the congregations that are now moving in this direction of going, well, you know, if Betsy wants us to have it, why not, you know, have our own schools, do our own thing? The problem is, there are many problems with it, but among them are that it destroys the community that you've constructed of many, many faith groups. In the blog I wrote, I talk about that in my hometown. It was a small town, a grocery store and a red light and, you know, a couple of gas stations kind of thing, and 26 churches. And those churches, though predominantly Christian, were of a wide variety of denominations and flavors and styles, and they were different for a reason. And so this idea that you can create a quote-unquote Christian school that will satisfy all of the denominations is really not a very logical and not very realistic goal, because not all congregations are alike.
Right. But I would argue, Cheryl, that the argument there is that each one of those 26 churches should have their own school. We could take that money and we can have our own little ideological slice of education, and everybody else is wrong and we're right. So creating this little insular world of, you know, all of these different faiths and types of education, that's kind of the argument and the utopia for a lot of the people who are pushing God Incorporated, in my view.
I don't think it is a utopia for them. And part of the problem is that you don't have the money to create 26 little schools. Right now, most congregations are struggling to keep their Sunday schools full.
Right.
Much less keep a weekday school full. So the problem of what can I provide for, you know, the 100 kids, the 60 kids, the 25 kids that belong to our congregation as a day school becomes, the vouchers are just not enough,
right,
to cover actually running a school. Every time you divide that money, each group gets less.
Right.
And so the one good school in the town is much more useful in supporting all of those Sunday schools and Saturday schools and synagogue than is the 26 separate schools.
I absolutely agree with you. I think most people would agree with you, Cheryl. But what we're talking about is we're talking about the fringe, the extreme, who sees this as an opportunity not just to cash in, but to also push their particular brand or version of Christianity.
You know, so many of the faiths in our country are so varied. even among what we think of as the Protestant Christians, that we need, they all came out of some form of religious persecution. And in the blog, the one I talk about is that the Baptists and came out of the persecution of Baptists in Massachusetts, and they had to go to Rhode Island and form Rhode Island in order to find a way to worship the way they wanted to worship. And so as a kid in a Baptist church, I was taught that religious freedom was very important, and that you did not want somebody in control of government dictating how people worshiped or dictating what was the legal religion. And that today we find Baptist ministers, Baptist congregations taking the opposite view of that, it really is amazing to me, because it flies in the face of their own history. And almost every denomination has that. You know, John Wesley was on the run at times for the Methodists. The Mormons wound up in Utah because they kept having to move. So all of our denominations have this problem that they are a minority, and they're only going to become more so, because as more and more people, our faiths are becoming more diverse, individual groups are going to become more smaller and more
radical
oriented.
I would argue more radical.
I'm not sure radical is going to be the right term. I don't think the radicalism that is currently underway among among the faith groups that would go for rules, regulations, strictness rather than mercy, kindness, compassion. I don't think congregations can sustain that stance for long.
Okay.
They run into the same problem that the Puritans ran into, that it's just too strict for everybody. Nobody can be that perfect.
No, I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. But you look at some of the, like the Quiverful movement, for instance. To them, the voucher idea is a way to, extract, finances from the federal government to fill their personal coffers. I mean, I look at the people who did that TV show for a while. Was it 19 and Counting? They were the kind of the heads, the titular heads of a kind of thought, Christian thought of how things should be. And in that world, vouchers are just the greatest thing in the world. But, on the other side of this, you go back to the founding of the country. And I remember reading about James Madison, who, one of his first vetoes was giving federal money to the churches. And he argued that, the Constitution was very clear. And this is the guy who wrote the thing. This is the father of the Constitution saying that, we chose specifically not to establish a religion. And there should be no money going into it. But his idea was a little different, as I remember it. His idea was, we didn't want the federal government, changing religious views. So you do your thing and the federal government will do it.
Which is absolutely one of the major reasons for not having religious vouchers, or even private ideologically driven vouchers, is that once the government controls the money, the government controls the curriculum.
Right, but isn't that what they say about public education? Isn't that the argument against public education?
Well, I think part of the reason we have so many restrictions on what we can and should teach in public schools is to maintain that freedom, that balance between individual freedom and equality for all, is one that the public schools have to walk all the time. And it's interesting how that particular dichotomy, that polarity, that push-pull between equality for all and individual freedom is the one we hear it echoed, starting with the Declaration of Independence, going through the Constitution, through Lincoln's addresses, through Martin Luther King Jr.'s addresses, that you have to meet that balance of maintaining freedom for the individual and the equal interest of all. And that desire to balance is what the public schools are charged with and why we are as regulated as we are, to keep us from walking on anybody, any particular group's toes, and to keep us teaching something that respects all, not just the few.
Right.
And so I think there's a strong argument to be made that some of the rigidity of the public school requirements are too much and have gone too far in particular directions. But in general, you have to have some means of making that, keeping that balance. And you cannot do that with vouchers. You cannot do that where you have fragmented the community so much that you cannot find community value.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of it, you know, there's so many reasons, in my view, to be against the vouchers. You know, from the part of trying to establish, you know, religious kind of schools, or, you know, more importantly to me is they never cover all of the costs. So what it ends up being is a huge tax break for people who are already sending their kids to private schools. Because, you know, as I've asked, you know, a state senator here in Pennsylvania in the past, who's a big proponent of vouchers, I said, you know, if I get this golden ticket, if I get this voucher, you know, the ticket to the middle class, my kid can go anywhere. And he's like, absolutely. And I said, so if I want to send my child to Abington Friends School in Philadelphia or Gilmore Academy or any of these other really prestigious schools, or like kindergarten's like $40,000, it's going to cover that, right? And he's like, absolutely, until you read the details. And absolutely is not even close, because my school district, I think, pays like $10,000 or $11,000 per student. Mm-hmm. I don't have $30,000 to make up the difference.
And it's likely the voucher will be in the neighborhood of 80% of that, because there will be some deduction for other things that aren't covered. So most of the vouchers, if your district is running about $10,000 for that, you may get 8, you may get 7. You're going to wind up paying $3,000 or $4,000 on top of that per child.
And again, you come back to this. It's not what it's sold to us as. And again, it's going to, in my view, be another massive redistribution of wealth from the poor and the working class of this country upward.
Well, and it's also going to be a redistribution of education itself, because the quality of the schools, and this has been shown in study after study, it's very difficult for people who went to private schools to come to grips with the idea that their schools are not necessarily superior to public schools, because that's an urban legend that is deeply embedded in the American dream, that going to a private school provides you a better education and that you get to become better educated. I think we have some glaring examples of how that has not held true.
Right.
Not just in the form of studies that show it as a blanket data point, but in terms of people like our president and Betsy DeVos, who were both educated at private, very high-priced private schools, and can't spell or speak correctly.
Yeah.
I mean, we have some real glaring examples right now that private schools do, and there are some very good ones. I'm not wanting to make a blanket statement that all private schools are bad, but the mythology that private schools are superior to public schools is just plain not true. And so when we start fragmenting our dollars, providing less, and fragmenting our communities, we're also going to be providing a lower quality of education for everyone. We're going to not just lose money for individual families, which we will. We're going to lose the future that our children might have had as brighter, smarter, more capable, more skilled adult human beings. So that's pretty scary.
Absolutely.
That we could lower the entire achievement. You want to talk an achievement gap? Lowering the quality of the entire nation's schools by fragmenting them into 1,000 pieces is one of the more bizarre kinds of, and it comes back to this idea that the reformers maintain that disruption is good. So even though it's disrupted right now, and it, these kids who are in it right now are not going to get what they really want, eventually it'll work out okay. And we're asked to trust them on that, that they're going to tear up our kitchen, and that they will show up sometime and come back and fix it. But that the money we paid them already for the kitchen remodel is going to sort of happen on their schedule. And I think that's one of the big problems with the reform proposal and the whole disruption is okay. We can break them all up like this. And then even if this kid has a rotten sixth grade year, it'll all work out for his little brother who's coming in a couple of years.
Yeah,
that doesn't work with children.
Yeah, you're right.
And it doesn't work on a family basis, that you've torn up our lives, our kitchen, so to speak, our school situation, where I have kids going to three different schools because to get what I need for each kid, because we don't have one school that has all the benefits, that has a music program, has an art program, has the athletic, has the science program that we need, because it's broken up into 1,000 little schools. And so I've got to drive the kids to three different schools because we no longer have the transportation we needed. It's the equivalent of somebody coming in and saying, I'm going to remodel your house, but I'm going to leave it a mess and come back and fix it when I feel like it.
No, we'll tear it down first.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And I love the choice argument. And the reality is you know, too many bad choices, in my view, that's not a good policy either. I mean, we saw this with the healthcare debate. So, you know, last line of thought, you know, what should people be pushing for then if vouchers and charters aren't the answer?
The answer is community involvement in our communities and in our schools. There is nothing in the current configuration that limits local businesses or even larger businesses, that limits local church groups or local ideological groups like the Lions Club or the Rotary Club from being involved in their school. They own those school buildings. We all together as a community own those school buildings and keep them up and do all of the programming that goes on in them. There is no reason that principals and superintendents and all of these various stakeholders can't get together and work out what they want.
There you go. Good
we
stuff.
We can talk together and decide what kinds of schools we want, what kinds of programs, what are our dreams for our kids, and what kind of economic boon do we want for our community? What kind of businesses do we want to attract? We want to attract high-tech businesses, then we're going to set up a tech program that will attract both grants and companies to our county. You know, we can talk through those things and figure them out.
Yeah, that sounds awful complicated. It's easier just to give money to the profiteers and let them figure it out.
And they will tell us what to do.
Oh, they surely will.
Whether we want to or not.
If you want to check out the piece, Why Congregations Across the Nation Should Stand Against Vouchers, just go to therickssmithshow.com. Click on Cheryl Gibbs Binkley's name. Take you right there. Great piece, Cheryl. I appreciate you taking time for us. As always, fantastic talking to you.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Great. Hey. I enjoy your show and keep doing it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.